From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In a political season that has featured the predictable parade of gaffes, game changers, and polls, there's been an interesting twist this week when the media decided that the juiciest line of inquiry about the GOP's newly minted vice presidential nominee, Paul Ryan, was how deep his allegiance was to the late and to some lamented objectivist political philosopher and novelist Ayn Rand and her advocacy of ethical egoism, also known as egoism.
He requires his staff to read Ayn Rand's novel Atlas Shrugged and calls Rand the reason I got involved in public service.
Ultra-capitalist Ayn Rand, of whom he has spoken glowingly.
What is your view of Ayn Rand? Are you an Ayn Rand disciple?
The New York Times op-ed board recently featured a nearly 1,000-word essay written by a Stanford history professor about how Ayn Rand wouldn't have approved of Ryan. Not to be outdone, MSNBC found footage that they say proves that even Johnny Carson didn't approve of Ayn Rand.
You do not believe in, I assume, that you do not believe in the existence of a supreme being or God or creator or whatever.
No, I do not.
Beneath this fixation about Ryan's Ayn Rand fandom is the notion that Atlas Shrugged might be the urtext that reveals Ryan's hidden, more extreme ideology. Later in the show, we'll explore America's enduring fascination with Rand, but first we asked Slate political reporter Dave Weigel for some background on Ryan's relationship to Rand.
Paul Ryan got to D.C. pretty much directly from college and worked his way up in the kind of conservative Republican infrastructure, which was quite strong. I mean, he took over Congress in 1994. He got to Congress only 4 years later. And so Ryan gave this speech to the Atlas Society, a kind of Randian objectivist group that's very involved in politics, gave a speech to them in 2005 and gave examples of Rand's work, Rand's characters influencing decisions he made.
I grew up reading Ayn Rand. And it taught me quite a bit about who I am and what my value systems are and what my beliefs are. The reason I got involved in public service, by and large, if I had to credit one thinker, one person, it would be Ayn Rand.
And then a couple of years later, he recorded a tape. This is during the Obama years, 2009, making an observation that was pretty popular at that time, which was that it seemed like we were living through Atlas Shrugged.
And that's supposed to suggest that he sees the world through John Galtian eyes. What does the world look like through that lens?
He's saying that I understand government whenever it tries to act, whenever it tries to redistribute wealth, it always loots. It gives from, to use Rand's phrases, from makers to takers. And it's morally debasing. It's spiritually debasing. It doesn't work. It brings an economy down. If you say something, as Ryan has said, it feels like we're living through Atlas Shrugged, that's what you mean. We saw in that novel that when you try to redistribute wealth, everyone ends up poor. I mean, you hear a lot of Republicans quote Lincoln or quote Reagan to make this point. But going to Rand, you're saying it's in a much more apocalyptic way. Government destroys society when it intervenes this way.
When did he begin to put some space between him and Rand?
It really starting in 2009, 2010, when his profile was rising, even when he talked to Randians, made it clear that he was a Christian and she's an atheist for reasons that are actually kind of quite important to this. 2011, he gave an interview to National Review and just said adamantly, I look to Thomas Aquinas, not to Rand. It wasn't an Apostle Peter type deal where he denied her and all her works. He didn't recant anything. It was just he said, no, I look to Christian thinkers. This became important because later people would show up at events he went to and brandish Bibles, trying to warn the world that he had read this atheist, objectivist, libertarian writer and that it would be a huge problem. That's around the time when he started to distance himself from this. And I should say, I've not really met any conservative who has said they have a problem with him because he's read Rand. I mean, a lot of them have, and there's no evidence that he is an atheist himself at all.
When you look at Ryan's budget plan, does that look like something that could have been written by a fan of Atlas Shrugged?
Well, it collapses tax rates into two very flat tax rates. It cuts corporate taxes. It cuts capital gains taxes. The reason it does all that is based on a lot of economic ideas. But I think it's easy to understand them if you understand what Rand thought the real damage of government could be. But you could point to that and point to Hayek. You could point to von Mises. You could point to more modern libertarian thinkers. You could point to, you know, like the work of Charles Murray on welfare. But Rand, as a thinker that basically every young conservative at least encounters, is very useful for explaining why people might look at government and make that decision.
So if somebody wants to understand Ryan, do you think they should read Rand?
I think absolutely. If you went to a Tea Party rally in 2009 or 10, you would occasionally see a Who is John Galt sign. Because if every page of the novel is not widespread, at least this idea is widespread. And at least the idea that if you tax people and demand that they make certain products and you regulate them out of making certain products, then you're doing what the villains in Atlas Shrugged did. You're going to force creative people into Galt's Gulch. People just bolt and flee and hide because they can't deal with the oppressive tax regime. And when you hear Republicans talk about the burdens on job creators, how people are holding money back from the economy, it's something economists can describe to you, but it's something that's even easier to describe if you just go to John Galt's speech in Atlas Shrugged.
Dave, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Dave Weigel covers politics for Slate.
We've seen no shortage of political ads that pander to our emotion. For example, the heartbreaking story of Joe Sopcich in this ad from the pro-Obama super PAC Priorities USA Action.
When Mitt Romney and Bain closed the plant, I lost my health care. A short time after that, my wife became ill, and I took her up to the Jackson County Hospital and admitted her for pneumonia, and that's when they found the cancer. And she passed away in 22 days.
But facts have a way of inconveniencing narratives. It turns out that Sopcich's wife had her own health insurance for 2 years after he lost his job. And she was diagnosed a full 5 years after Sopcich's steel mill closed. Another example, in this ad paid for by the Romney campaign, a small businessman named Jack Gilchrist reacts to an artfully edited out-of-context excerpt from an Obama speech praising our land of opportunity.
If you've got a business, that, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
My father's hands didn't build this company. My hands didn't build this company. My son's hands aren't building this company. Did somebody else take out the loan on my father's house to finance the equipment?
Well, maybe not, but Gilchrist excludes from his story a surprising amount of government assistance, including $800,000 in New Hampshire tax-exempt revenue bonds and a couple of federal contracts. Kathleen Hall Jamison, a professor of communication at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, says that in this post-Citizens United world, we're going to see more ads and more untrue ads than ever before.
And because you have unlimited amounts of third-party money sloshing through the system, there will be higher levels of third-party expenditure than we've ever seen before. And third-party advertising, that's non-candidate advertising, is historically more attack-driven and also more deceptive.
Now, I'm not sure we necessarily agree. I believe that most political advertising constitutes big lies built on nominal facts. And you tend to believe that most political advertising is at least technically truthful. Has any of this year's advertising made you come around to my way of thinking?
No, but as your proportion of third-party advertising increases, the likelihood that I'm going to start to adopt your conclusion increases. Historically, if you look at all of the ads run in the general election, you will find that in most presidential ads, most of the statements are accurate. You are working in a world in which you pay a lot of attention to the controversial ads magnified up through media coverage. The ads that aren't controversial play, but they don't get into media. And as a result, increases the likelihood that you overgeneralize the extent of the problematic.
I'm cherry picking, in other words.
That doesn't mean that there isn't a lot. Over one out of two of the third-party ads contains at least one documentable deception so far this election year.
Let's talk about the news media's role. You believe that on balance, actually, the media have had a palliative effect on political advertising, that with fact-checking, for example, they've helped keep campaigns themselves relatively honest.
I wouldn't say relatively honest. I would say more honest. Let me give you some quick examples. Remember the opening shot in the Romney campaign with the attack on President Obama, taking a statement that he made, quoting John McCain from 2008, and made it appear that he was speaking about the current campaign.
If we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose.
I'm going to do something
the
to government.
Journalistic enterprise went after that aggressively to say it was out of context. Let's take an example from the other side. The fact checkers went after the claim about Romney as outsourcer-in-chief. At issue was whether he had day-to-day managerial responsibility at Bain when the outsourcing occurred. Fact-checkers said not while he had managerial control. Can you call them his firms? Yes. His name is still on the firm. And as a result, that essential indictment of Romney is pushed to greater accuracy.
You were talking about the tendency of these third-party organizations being less chastened by the fact-checking process. There's one case brewing right now. Former special forces officers, mainly in the Navy SEALs, going after the president. Have you seen this campaign video?
Yes, it's a web video, and it's got two trailers attached to it. It's 22 minutes, and they're starting to get news play, having not yet aired any of it. And it has statements in it that should be considered extremely problematic. For example, Bin Laden's picture with the question mark after dead on the screen, and a statement that says, it's my civic duty to tell the president.
It is my civic duty to tell the president to stop leaking information to the enemy.
There's no evidence that the president leaked information to anyone. Now, when television stations get these ads, they ought to look carefully at those statements and reject those ads. This group is a 501c4. It doesn't have to disclose its donors, so we don't know who's behind it. But stations have the right on any third-party political ad to just say no and not air that content.
But the cable channels almost certainly will air it for free to discuss the controversy. And you'd be naive to think that that isn't very often the strategy of these special interest organizations.
And we have a model for how journalism should treat that discussion. They should be airing it and treating it the way they treated the ad you opened your segment with, that Mitt Romney is somehow responsible for the death of the woman. The fact that that web video never has been aired is, to me, an indication that strong journalistic pushback on specious, sleazy political claims and insinuations can, in fact, blunt their impact.
As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is professor of communications at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania.
Coming up, one woman's commitment to let no homicide in her city go unreported or unremembered.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As you just heard, political ads are flying fast, furious, and frequently fallacious, especially those from super PACs and third-party groups. So we're relaunching our Media Scrutiny Theater series. What's Media Scrutiny Theater? Well, it's our take on the late, great Mystery Science Theater, which was basically the silhouettes of one human and two robots in front of a big screen in a dark theater making fun of bad science fiction films.
Since a few years ago, the Wall Street Journal dubbed us the irrepressibly snide duo, we thought we might as well apply that talent to what are indisputably the worst short films of the season, the current crop of political ads. It's not all snark, because Brooke insists on a few fact checks. But we thought a little video would make this necessary confrontation with the good, the bad, and the ugly go down a little easier.
We are Americans, likely voters in the swing states of Iowa and Wisconsin.
This is in black and white, so they're obviously evil.
Who shares your values?
Nobody. If they want values, let them get their own.
As president, Barack Obama has never visited Israel.
Or Gaza, Lebanon, Argentina.
Sweden, Hungary.
Holland, Disney World.
Duh. It's all Romney's fault.
I do not think Mitt Romney is concerned.
Murderer.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And that is who?
So check out Media Scrutiny Theater. You'll find it at www.onthemedia.org/blogs/MST. There'll be two of them a week through the election. So let us know what you think.
On July 30th, the Washington Post announced a $500,000 grant from the Ford Foundation to expand coverage that would be used for, quote, special projects related to politics, money, and government. This is the second Ford Foundation grant awarded to a newspaper this year, with $500,000 going to the L.A. Times in May. Nonprofit giving to the ailing for-profit newspaper industry seems like it might just be a present and future business model for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Present and future business models to monetize the newspaper industry.
But when a nonprofit starts subsidizing the operations of a for-profit newspaper, some questions come up. Jonathan Barzilay of the Ford Foundation joins us now to address them. Jonathan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be here.
When a newspaper accepts outside funding, let's say not from an advertiser or a subscriber, is there a surrender of editorial independence?
The newspapers have complete editorial independence over what they cover. And you raise the correct precedent, I think, which is that for over 100 years, American newsrooms have been supported by advertisers, and the leadership of those newsrooms have managed to balance independent editorial news gathering against the commercial support that they get from advertisers. We have confidence that the leadership of the LA Times and the Washington Post can manage any balancing that's required here.
Isn't the earmark itself almost by definition a kind of dictation of coverage?
Our interest is in supporting principal journalistic coverage of complex social issues. How that is done is entirely up to the newsrooms. It's true that if a newsroom had come to us and said, we'd like support for a reporter to cover interplanetary exploration, that's not something we would entertain because it's not an area in which our foundation works. But the areas in which we are supporting coverage here were determined by the newspapers themselves. They came to us and said, this is what we'd like to do. We do not have the resources to cover these areas. And we were receptive to that.
The Washington Post and the LA Times both are in financial extremis and have been for years, and as a consequence have been cutting and slashing away. Now, the Post, the newspaper, is a subsidiary of the Washington Post company, which has other interests. And when they cut from the newspaper, it gets moved to the bigger corporation. So if they cut $500,000 out of their budget in 2013, have you not just written a $500,000 check to the Washington Post company?
We certainly can't draw a line and say that we could only consider supporting a standalone company. Many journalistic enterprises are part of larger corporations. The fact is those newsrooms also remain under tremendous pressure. Our grants, they are specifically designated for hiring certain reporters to cover certain beats. The beats are determined by the newspaper and the coverage is determined by the newspaper, but it's not the case that this is the same money that gets moved around.
The Ford Foundation is a tax-exempt organization, which means that one step removed, there's a federal subsidy to the Washington Post that is part and parcel of this $500,000 grant. Are you concerned at all, or should I be concerned, that this is an indirect taxpayer support for a for-profit enterprise?
We're not the first foundation to make a grant to a for-profit news-gathering operation. So there's precedent for it, and indeed the IRS rules contemplate grants to for-profit enterprises. And I'd like to point out the lion's share of the money that we grant in this area continues to go to public media. We support New York Public Radio, Southern California Public Radio, WGBH, WNET, NPR. And we look at these two grants to the LA Times and the Washington Post as experimental grants, as part of a balanced portfolio that is interested in sustaining the vital role of serious journalism in our democracy.
Does this mean that public radio is suddenly in competition not only with other public media, but with the entire for-profit journalism world for the funding from foundations like yours?
I think it's fair to say that the future is a model of hybrids, right? ProPublica, which is a not-for-profit newsroom staffed largely by people who previously worked at big city dailies and investigative newsrooms across the country, has been awarded two Pulitzer Prizes and numerous other accolades, and its journalism is having an impact all over the country. And it may be the case that in the future, public media will feel a little different than it does today, and private media will feel a little different than it does today. Our interest at the Ford Foundation is in the broader issue. if we don't support this, will this coverage vanish? It has vanished in certain cities, it has vanished in certain markets, and we think it's vital to continue investing in the production of serious news gathering. To wake up 10 years hence without serious news gathering in this country would be an immeasurable loss.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Jonathan Barsalet is director of the Freedom of Expression Unit at the Ford Foundation. Public radio has been accepting nonprofit grants for decades, and NPR's Senior Vice President for News, Margaret Lowe Smith, says that there should be no worries about any editorial impropriety resulting from those grants, because it's not the foundations coming to public radio with an editorial agenda, it's the other way around.
So, for example, if you have a foundation interested in investigations or science coverage, we will go to them for certain kinds of grants in general. It's not like a funder comes to us and says, hey, we want you to do X, Y, and Z, and we say, yes, that simply can't happen. It has to be the reverse order.
So the Gates Foundation might underwrite coverage for global health issues or education, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, a longtime underwriter, subsidizes coverage on health care and so forth.
Exactly.
Now, the obvious risk would be for some funder to say, look here, I don't like your coverage of this, that, or the other thing. This needs to be addressed. Fix it. Do this, do that.
God forbid that were to happen, it wouldn't be possible for them to be an NPR underwriter. There's sort of a, in effect, an explicit agreement, which is that we go to underwriters with areas of coverage that we define as vitally important for us to report on. They may or may not be interested, but if they say they're interested, they're supporting our editorial agenda.
Your editorial calendar and your resources are determined in part by what pots of money you have available to you. Is there not some surrender of editorial independence because of the budget situation?
I think you're making the assumption that we cover what people are willing to pay for rather than we say, here's what we want to cover. This is a priority whether we get funding or not. If you can pay for it, it will make it possible. I'm not even sure I cede the notion or the idea that it's earmarked and therefore allows us to do more of one thing and less of another.
Is there anything about the connection between foundations and for-profit papers that raises a red flag for you?
What strikes me almost immediately, Bob, is that people are in some ways emulating what public media has done for a long time. You know, obviously, I think there are questions to be answered in terms of how it's going to work and whether it will be successful.
There was a time when NPR was sort of the heroic alternative to the dominant for-profit media out there that were just money engines. Did you ever imagine that you'd be having this conversation?
No, and it's actually, I think it's painful for all of us to watch the bottom fall out of a really important industry. And I don't think I saw it coming, and quite honestly, I don't think my journalist counterparts at newspapers saw it coming either.
Margaret, one last question. Now, not just editorially, but financially, you are in competition with the LA Times and the Washington Post and perhaps others looking for foundation funding. Are you going to target these news organizations and destroy them?
As news organizations, you know, you're always in a kind of competition to be the very best, to have the most compelling and important coverage. That being said, I think to sort of see it as something that's going to eat our lunch is not the right way to look at it. I think it's a real statement about the importance of the business that we're in. And that if the commercial market isn't going to support journalism, that people are going to have to seek other ways to make sure that this work continues to get done.
Margaret, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bob. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Margaret Lowe Smith is Senior Vice President for News at NPR.
A well-intended grant is having an unintended impact on an unorthodox news-gathering operation, Homicide Watch, a website that tracks every murder in the Washington, D.C. area. The two-year-old website has only one full-time staffer, its founder, Laura Amico. Next week, she'll begin a year as a Nieman Berkman Fellow in Journalism Innovation at Harvard. Her plan was to keep the site up and running during the fellowship. But after a last-minute deal with a local news outlet to take it over fell through, the future of Homicide Watch is uncertain. With the possibility looming that this singular site could end, we're rerunning last November's conversation with Amico. She explained why she posts the names of murder victims even before the police do.
People are talking about crimes that they're seeing, and they want there to be a place to find information and connect right away. They want to leave memorial messages for the victim. They want to talk about the suspect. It's about providing crime coverage that is complete and honors the experiences that people have in their lives, in their experiences with violent crime.
So how do you get the jump on the cops?
By watching Twitter and Facebook and my web search analytics.
Okay.
Basically, what happens is that someone goes to a search engine, Google or Bing or something like that, and types in what they want information about, right?
Mm-hmm.
We often see people searching victims' names and suspects' names, addresses where they know a crime has occurred. When people come into Homicide Watch by searching those terms, I see that search term that they initially used to find me. A lot of times those give me clues on what's actually happening out there in the streets.
People will search for you as a crime reporter to find out about something you haven't written about, and you turn around and use their search parameters to search it yourself.
Exactly.
What sort of terms do you use when you're searching Twitter and Facebook?
It's taken a lot of practice to learn the terms that are most important in my community. I search RIP with and without periods, rest in paradise, SMH, short for shaking my head, tears, visual, V-I-S-U-A-L, is often used to mean vigil for a candlelight vigil.
Can you give me an example of how it works?
Sure. A couple weekends ago, I woke up early one Sunday morning and checked the community listservs, as I often do, and saw that there was a police report that a juvenile male had died after being stabbed about 7:30 the evening before. And that happened on a street they listed as Quincy Street Northwest. When I looked at my Google analytics, I saw search terms, including killing of Jamal in D.C., October 8th, 2011, a 16 was killed in Washington, D.C., and a man was murdered on Quincy Street Northwest on October 8th, 2011. Those are all search terms that people were using to find my site.
So, you had those clues, then what did you do?
I took those clues to Twitter, and I started searching Jamal, RIP, 16-year-old, and that led me to a Facebook profile of a 17-year-old named Jamar Freeman. His friends and family were leaving memorial messages connected to his Facebook and Twitter accounts. Finally, one of them linked to my initial report, just stating that a crime had occurred. At that point, that was confirmation for me.
So you don't go to the police after to make sure you've got it right?
A press release was eventually issued in that case. The press releases happen on their own time, and in this case, that wasn't until a day and a half later.
Do you ever worry about wrongly identifying someone?
I don't publish until I am absolutely certain that what I have is correct.
How is what you do different from what eventually comes out in the paper?
Homicide Watch is set up around people. We have individual pages for every victim and every suspect. Every story that I write appears on that victim or suspect's page. So with one click, you can see everything from their obituary to the initial report of the crime, to who was arrested, to where that is in the court's process, to maybe a profile, interesting comments that others have left in their memory, which is something that I think you don't see in a lot of either daily newspapers or news websites. Having that all in one place gives more of a complete picture than a crime brief every so often.
Do you try and cover every single homicide in D.C.?
Every single homicide.
Are you familiar with the great Miami crime reporter Edna Buchanan?
I am, yes.
She used to pride herself on knowing every homicide case in Miami. When she went on vacation, she would come back and check on the murders that she missed. And here's a story that she once told me.
And one was the murder of this young man who lived with his grandmother. And I happened to find myself in that neighborhood, and I stopped by, knocked at the door, And she opened it, and I introduced myself and said I wanted to talk to her about her grandson. And she took a deep breath, stepped back, threw the door open wide, and invited me in. And she said, I wondered why nobody came.
That's really what I find happens every day covering this beat. People have these deeply emotional moments. And what we see is that when they're not asked for their stories, and when they're not asked what happened, they get the impression that it doesn't matter. Their son's life or their mother's life wasn't worth talking about. And I think that's the saddest thing.
You remind me of Edna Buchanan.
Brooke, that story means so much to me, and that really just made my day.
Laura Amico runs Homicide Watch DC. Laura, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Amico has created a Kickstarter campaign to keep Homicide Watch going for the coming year by turning it into a journalism training lab of sorts to teach students how to do crime reporting. We'll link to that campaign on our website.
Coming up, a pioneering publisher who taught women how to enjoy sex, to please their men, and to keep on buying magazines.
For so many years, you couldn't talk about it or write about it or do anything about it. You weren't even supposed to do it. And if you did it, you couldn't tell anybody. And that was only like, 10 or 15 years ago. So I think we still have a lot of playing to do and a lot of writing and reading and movie making and all that before we get it out of our systems and people say, okay, we can write about something else.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence. At thescanfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So as we heard, with the announcement that Paul Ryan would be the GOP's vice presidential nominee, Ayn Rand was back in the news. Though Rand has been dead for 30 years, the political philosophy she espoused in her novels, plays, and screenplays lives on. And as we observed in this piece I reported a few years ago, nothing makes a philosophical argument go down more smoothly than when it's embodied by Gary Cooper, who played the iconoclast architect Howard Roark in a film version of The Fountainhead.
If you want my work, you must take it as it is or not at all.
Do you wish to defy our common standards?
I set my own standards.
Do you intend to fight against the whole world?
If necessary.
And lest Gary Cooper fails to appeal to the kids these days, there's a concerted effort to reach the kids where they are, in school. For years, John A. Allison led that effort.
My favorite book is Atlas Shrugged, which is the best defense, I believe, of capitalism ever written.
Atlas Shrugged, of course, is Rand's apocalyptic doorstop of a novel that depicts an intrusive government that forces creators to flee. For almost 40 years, Allison was the head of a very large bank, BB&T, which offered generous grants to colleges and universities that agreed to teach Atlas Shrugged. Since 2005, it's given millions of dollars to nearly 70 institutions of higher learning for the study of Rand's philosophy called objectivism. Some academics don't like the conflict of interest that this arrangement represents, but objectivists say it's perfectly reasonable. It certainly wouldn't have bothered Rand.
I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on faith, not on emotion, not on arbitrary edict, but on reason. Morality which can be proved by means of logic.
Let's put it this way. Ayn Rand's work, I think, is popular for the same reason Prometheus has always been popular with humans. It's about somebody who dares to struggle against great odds and, you know, steals fire.
Nick Gillespie is the editor of Reason.com and Reason TV and former editor of Reason Magazine, a libertarian journal whose name is a nod to Rand's favorite word. Reason above all. Reason above conventional pieties, reason above religion, above especially collectivist societies and command economies, the horrors of which she witnessed as a child in St. Petersburg during the Russian Revolution. Reason that finds its purest expression in capitalism.
virtually every CEO of every major company will list Ayn Rand as a major influence. A bevy of Hollywood stars ranging from Brad Pitt to Angelina Jolie to Vince Vaughn, a director like Oliver Stone, who is fond of Castro, says that Ayn Rand is one of the most important figures in his intellectual life. Martina Navratilova, Billie Jean King, Hugh Hefner. I mean, the reach of this author is pretty astonishing. She gives egoists a positive case for why the world should revolve around them and around their efforts. If you are the person who is creating value, if you are the star, the sun really does revolve around you. And not only should it be that way, but that's the moral order of the universe.
Ayn Rand's philosophy was fundamentally selfish. Respond.
Ayn Rand's philosophy is fundamentally reality-oriented.
Jeffrey Britting is the archivist of the Ayn Rand Institute and associate producer of the documentary Ayn Rand, A Sense of Life.
Human beings live their own life. Human beings implement their own thinking. They pursue their own happiness. That's ultimately a very selfish act. And that's a virtue, in her opinion.
Ayn Rand thinks that people who raise money for other people or provide services for other people in an organized way are weak and deluded.
Absolutely not. That is a flat-out distortion of Ayn Rand from A to Z. And if you wish to see the evidence for that, please consult her novels and please consult her views on charity and please consult her views on scholarships and please consult her views on friendship and gift giving and Christmas and good cheer.
You don't like altruists.
I disapprove of them. I regard them as evil.
Phil Donahue interviewed Rand in 1980.
What's bad about the person who wants to help other people?
To begin with, that's the big mistake. People can want to help other people properly and with very good reasons. But that isn't altruism. Altruism doesn't mean merely helping people. It means sacrificing yourself to others. Placing the interests of others above your own is the self-sacrificing person who is an altruist.
Now, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with committing suicide? What's wrong with giving up life? And why is the happiness of another person important and good, but not your own?
Although she professed to live this life of reason, she herself lived a life of turbulent unreason.
Algis Volunis is contributing editor at The New Atlantis.
She had an affair when she was 49 with an acolyte of hers, a married man who was 25 years younger than she. She expected her husband and his wife to simply accept this affair as the perfectly reasonable thing to do. And for 12 years, they spent a couple of afternoons in her bedroom each week while slowly her lover's marriage dissolved and her husband became a virtual alcoholic. And when she was 61, her lover Nathaniel Brandon dumped her for a younger woman and she went crazy. All this vaunted reason of hers went right out the window.
Her lover's act, though cold, was perfectly rational.
She thought that if individuals wished to show compassion, they could do so, but they were under no obligation to do so. And for the most part, she looked on compassion as something morally slovenly, a concession that the strong made to the weak at the expense of their own excellence. She writes about compassion in The Fountainhead as what you feel when you see a caterpillar squashed.
Self-sacrifice, we drool, is the ultimate virtue. Let's stop and think. Can a man sacrifice his integrity, his rights, his freedom, his convictions, the honesty of his feeling, the independence of his thought? These are a man's supreme possessions. It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man above all. And where do we find it? In a man like Howard Roark.
It is the unsacrificed self that we must respect in man, but not perhaps in woman.
At the center of The Fountainhead is a scene of what can only be called consensual rape, in which Dominique Francone, the heroine, who is this masterful woman, but a virginal one, is overcome by Howard Roark in a scene of great passionate savagery.
She
She describes it as the act of a master taking shameful, contemptuous possession of her was the kind of rapture she had always wanted.
Writer Amy Benfer.
I think one of the big problems one runs into quite early, if you're a woman reading an Ayn Rand novel, is that she sort of paradoxically believed that a woman's place was to find a hero and worship him.
But as a kid, Amy Benfer slid past that part and briefly became an objectivist. She wrote a piece for In Character called Randy Girls, Adolescent Teenage Girls Love Ayn Rand. Wonder why?
Like in fairy tales, there are very few mothers in these stories. Almost nobody has a mother. Also, none of her characters have children. The female characters are extremely unencumbered by domestic responsibilities. And I also think the core idea of selfishness is sort of liberating to a teenage girl who is told that her noblest goal in life is to take care of other people.
In fact, that reminds me of a scene from The Simpsons where Marge brings little Maggie into the Ayn Rand School for Tots.
Maggie likes a bottle of warm milk before nap time.
A bottle? Mrs. Simpson, do you know what a baby's saying when she reaches for a bottle?
Baba?
She's saying, I am a leech. Our aim here is to develop the bottle within.
As research for her piece, Benfer wrote to book editors she knew trolling for opinions about Rand.
One book editor wrote back to me and said, I avoided reading Ayn Rand until I was 22. And after I finished The Fountainhead, I felt I had discovered something very important. Never date a boy who is reading The Fountainhead. Another reply I received pointed me to a fake blurb on the back of John Stewart's recent book, America the Book, attributed falsely, of course, to Ayn Rand. And it reads, this book is similar to my works in that anyone who reads it is sure to become an asshole for at least a month afterwards.
Nick Gillespie of Reason says he was never wowed by Rand's novels, but that the attacks on them are often swipes by people who would rather not seriously engage her ideas.
How many characters from Saul Bellow novels, how many characters from Don DeLillo novels, inarguably great writers, how many of them have penetrated the American cultural consciousness in the way that a Howard Roark or a John Galt has, to a degree where these are shorthands for an entire system of ideas? I think that that speaks pretty highly of her power as a writer. She is a great author because she has a phenomenal audience, including a lot of people who go through a worshipful phase with her. And, you know, here we could be talking about Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve, as well as any number of pimply-faced adolescents who decide to grow beyond her.
She put the individual front and center in life and in death. Here she is 2 years before she died.
What I've always thought was a sentence from some Greek philosopher. I don't, unfortunately, remember who it was that I read at 16, and it's affected me all my life. I will not die. It's the world that will end. And that's absolutely true. And, you know, for me now, it should be a serious question because my time is fairly limited, and I have the same feeling that I will enjoy life to the last moment. And when it's the end, I don't have to worry about it. I'm not there. It's too bad that the world will end, and I think a very wonderful world will end with me.
There's a lot to be said for the consolation of philosophy. A grand dame of the New York magazine world died this week. Helen Gurley Brown made Cosmopolitan the global brand it is today. Her career took off after publishing her first book, Sex and the Single Girl, in 1962, which dispelled any doubt about a simple fact. Unmarried women like to have sex. It sold millions of copies. Joining me now is Letty Cotton Pogrebin, a writer, journalist, and founding editor of Ms. Magazine. She did publicity and advertising for Sex and the Single Girl at the time it was published. Letty, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Fun to be here.
What was the public reaction?
There was a lot of hoopla. I booked her on virtually all the talk shows. I sent her around to about 25 or 30 cities. It was transgressive, but she packaged it in a way where, you know, no four-letter words were spoken. And it was charming, and it was breathy and palatable somehow.
Why did she write the book?
As I remember it, she was 37 when she got married, and she had had a host of experiences as a single woman in a world in which you had to be coupled, and most people from Arkansas, where she came from, were married out of high school. And so she obviously had a lot of sex. I remember when she was writing the book, she said to me, you know, the one thing I never had was a matinee. I said, what's a matinee? She said, that's a middle-of-the-day affair. A working man and a working woman going off to a hotel in the middle of the day. I said, oh, I have a friend who's done that. And so I got my friend to contribute to her book. But that was the only thing she felt she couldn't speak authoritatively about.
This is so Mad Men.
That's true. I mean, that is exactly what our life was like, Helen's and mine. So if you think about Mad Men, you know why we had to plot and plan and strategize, because I mean, I recall being trapped in an elevator with a man who had a lot of power to really hurt my career. And he put his hand up my skirt, and I had to, from the 35th floor in Rockefeller Center down to the lobby, laugh him off, joke about it, be witty, be charming, because if I had made a fuss, he could have said anything. So Helen came from that. That was her context. That was mine. And we adapted. It was, you know, way before sexual harassment was illegal. There was no Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. So I guess that's why I kind of understood where she was coming from.
So you were in the vanguard of the feminist movement. In the 70s, a group of feminists organized a sit-in in Helen Gurley Brown's office because of what they thought of her retrograde vision of what a woman ought to be. How did you feel about events like that, and how did she feel about it?
Well, I was part of a sit-in at the Ladies' Home Journal when we were demanding that John McCarter step down and give the spot to a woman, and a sit-in at the New York Times demanding that more women be given book reviews and all that sort of thing. But I suppose for me it's a question of choosing your battles. And it didn't seem one that was worthy of a lot of attention. At the same time, I recognized that all those cover lines, which, you know, we found laughable, some people took seriously.
Like?
Oh, the sex secret no man can resist.
Wait, they just had that in their last issue, didn't they?
Was that in their last issue?
In every issue.
It's in every issue. She was the cutting edge on this one issue, and that is women are entitled to sexual pleasure. Now, part of that message was, and in order to get it, you have to please men. But it was reciprocal in her view. So for that era, when we were all supposed to be virgins, and I mean it. I mean, when I went back to my college reunion, all of us who had pretended to each other we were virgins admitted we weren't at the time. And Helen just outed everybody.
It's weird, you know, since her day, we've had feminism, post-feminism, third-wave feminism, lipstick feminism. Has it circled somewhere back to where she started?
Well, you know, it's a curious kind of arc, the way Helen used the female body and the way lipstick feminists, or sex-confident feminists, use their body is similar. But in Cosmo terms, you show your body to get men. In today's feminist body pride terms, it's you show your body because you own it, it's yours, and nobody can go near it unless you say so. So the purpose is entirely different. Maybe the impact or the appearance ends up looking the same, which is why I think your question is so apt.
For years in Cosmo, she gave advice to millions of women about sex and fashion and careers. What piece of advice do you remember her most for?
Well, I always remember, and I mean, I didn't use this advice, but I will never forget it. She always said that women should shout out when a man is having an orgasm what they want. And I said, well, like, what sort of thing? And she said, what you should really always shout is money. Because then he will always associate the ultimate in pleasure with you wanting money. She had a very, I have to say, simplistic view of life. She really did believe that women had wiles and men had needs, and you just had to put the two together and everything would work out.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Really fun talking to you about Helen, I must say.
Letty Cotton Pogrebin is a writer, journalist, and founding editor of Ms. Magazine.
I feel being a sex object is so divine and so wonderful that there is nothing better that you can be a sex object and you can also be the president of General Motors. I think men are sex objects, and it certainly doesn't slow you down that women desire you sexually. You're still able to get on with your work every day.
No, I wouldn't be able to get my work done every day if I did what Cosmo expected of me.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Bernie Bernstein, with more help from Ariel Stolberg and edited by Brooke. Thanks this week to WNYC's archivist Andy Lancet. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.